Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You know when you get out of the subway and just automatically walk towards your destination? Maybe you know that when you get out of the stop and you walk towards the Empire State Building, you're going north, or that coffee shop where you get your cup of joe is to the west, but you're not really thinking about it. Well, that's actually not just simple memorization. It's actually called cognitive mapping, and it's your innate knowledge of your environment and using markers to get around, and it's one of the first and most basic ways humans explored their surroundings. That's just one of the many fun facts in the new book, How to Travel Anywhere and Not Get Lost, A Guide to Navigation for Young Adventurers, an interactive book for young explorers, and the young at heart, by the way, about the history of navigation and travel way before the invention of GPS, although GPS is covered as well. Tracing navigation from its beginnings, readers get a look at how different and diverse cultures found their way in the world by using the sun, the stars, water patterns, and homemade compasses to travel. The book also includes hands-on activities for kids who've been staring at screens for the last year, like how to find the north and the south by reading trees, or using the stars to tell time, or making your own sundial. The book is by author, journalist, and adventurer Hans Ascham, and he joins me here today. Hans, welcome to the show.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
So why did you want to write about navigation, and why for kids?
So I was really fortunate to spend a lot of time outdoors as a kid. I grew up on the shores of Lake Michigan, and a lot of that time was unsupervised. So my parents kind of gave me some basic outdoor skills and then left me to my own devices. And I learned pretty quickly that if I wanted to keep that freedom, I needed to get home for dinner on time. So I learned those basic skills, but I never really had a fun, practical guide to navigation that put it in the kind of historical and scientific context. So I wanted to tell that story and make it more complete while keeping it practical and actionable and fun.
So many parents are looking to get their kids outside after a year of screen overload, but that was an issue even before the pandemic. How did you factor that into your writing process?
I mean, no one could have predicted what this last year was like. But I know that I've always learned best when I'm able to go out and try something, especially if it's outside. And so I wanted to make sure that everything in this book was something that a kid could read and then almost immediately look outside their window and see it for themselves. I think that makes such a lasting impression. And so at every step of the way, there's activities and there's quick little observations that you don't need to be out in the woods to do these things. You can simply look outside your window.
You also write about a lot of history in this book, and you're very straightforward about exploration that's been both enriching to the world and exploitative. So how did you reconcile those conflicts while taking on this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So navigation is one of the key drivers of all human history. It's how we've been able to connect and share ideas and share culture, and a lot of the innovations were really driven by kind of brutal periods in history. So whether that was colonialization or kind of the rise of globalization, or even kind of more recently with things like radio navigation and GPS with war, I think as kids learn about how amazing these things are, how cool the science is behind them, it's really important to put in context that they weren't always used for good intentions or equitable intentions.
And also the idea that indigenous cultures existed before some of the great people were discovered, right?
Absolutely. And that's something that, in doing my research and kind of discovering this field on a deeper level, I found so many of these navigation techniques were being developed by different cultures all around the world, kind of before they ever contacted one another. So like celestial navigation, for example, Polynesians were doing this thousands and thousands of years ago, back before any, kind of major contact with certainly Western cultures or cultures in South Asia, East Asia. So really, it shows that there's this really universal kind of desire to explore intentionally through navigation.
My guest is Hans Ascham. The name of his book is How to Travel Anywhere and Not Get Lost, A Guide to Navigation for Young Adventurers. I mentioned cognitive mapping as one of the early ways that early humans got around.
It's how to go anywhere and not get lost.
Oh, wait. You're right. Hang on. I've got it in front of me. How to go anywhere and not get lost. Thank
there we
you.
Go.
got the book right here in front of my face. I mentioned cognitive mapping as one of the early ways that early humans got around before we think of what maps and cartography today. You mentioned the internal compass as well. Can you kind of give me a definition of internal compass and how it works with cognitive mapping?
Yeah, so the internal compass is it's when within your brain there's a really small trace amount of magnetized metal, basically. And this is more common and like more acutely seen in certain species of animals. So tortoises are one that come to mind. Sea tortoises cross thousands and thousands of miles of ocean every year as part of their migration patterns. And they use that internal compass to like literally navigate back to the beaches where they, you know, kind of meet and mate every year. And in humans, it's definitely less acute and less felt. And so we really had to go out of our way to learn and develop these as skills, not something where we've evolved with quite as much. Cognitive mapping is something that you can improve. You can actually like get better at kind of mapping your surroundings. Just by like literally sitting down and thinking through a space that you're familiar with. So thinking of whether it's your house or maybe your school or your block or your city and kind of going out and kind of mapping it in your own mind can actually make you better at finding your way when you have a goal in mind.
Yeah, you have an activity in here called Map It Out. So what's part one of Map It Out and what's part two?
Part one of Map It Out is I have to check that.
It's page 10.
Part one of mapping it out is like I said, sitting down and thinking about it. And part two is sitting down and drawing it. So actually making your own map of those surroundings and kind of noting those different landscapes and noting those different landmarks within that cognitive map that you have in your mind. And then and checking and seeing how accurate you were.
My guest is Hans Ascham. The name of his book is How to Go Anywhere and Not Get Lost. Let's talk about the stars and the sun. The sun can help us with our directions. It's something listeners can try. Can you explain how the sun's impact on trees can help someone if they feel like they're not quite sure of their sense of direction?
Yeah, so trees are amazing at giving us a sense of our direction. So just like the houseplants on your windowsill, trees are always going to grow toward where there's more light. It's called photokinesis. And trees in the northern hemisphere are going to grow kind of thicker and fuller and just generally healthier on the south side. And that's because throughout the course of the year, they're going to get more sunlight on that side. So if you go out look out your window and look at a tree, and you can test this right away, and look at what side of the tree has kind of a more full growth on it, and it's likely going to be the south side. So you have to be aware of the different environmental factors that could block sunlight or reflect sunlight. So if you live across from a glass building that reflects sunlight, that could kind of interrupt that photokinesis. And that's why with navigation, it's so important to always get multiple sources of information. So trees are a great quick single source, but it's always good to check it against other sources of information like the sun itself to kind of check your work and make sure you're on the right track.
And your book offers a little bit of history and perspective on the sun and navigation. And there's interesting information about Gosek's Circle. What was the Gosek Circle? When was it discovered and what can we learn about it?
So the Gosek Circle is a massive, massive stone structure from Germany that was used to kind of help farmers prepare each season on when to plant their crops. So this is before we had handy calendars telling us exactly what time of year it was and how to use the sun as a really consistent source of information. And so the Gothic Circle dates back, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And it kind of looks like a massive bullseye. And if you stand in the middle of it on, like, an equinox, you'll see the sun's perfectly lined up with the different kind of cutouts within this stone circle. And, yeah, that's going back 7,000 years ago. And so that's in Germany, but you'll find these similar sorts of stone structures all around the world. There's a massive one in Alberta, Canada, the Medicine Wheel, that basically does the same thing. It's even bigger, though. I think it's the size of, like, 3 or 4 football fields. So this kind of goes back to that idea that humans have been catching on to these things and kind of innovating around them in sort of similar ways, independent of any single culture discovering one thing.
Let's talk about the stars, since we talked about the sun. You know, early navigators, sailors still use the night sky. I think we've all heard about the North Star or Polaris. But you get into the crux as well. So tell us, what is the crux and how does it help us with our navigation?
Yeah, so the crux is essentially the southern hemisphere's pole star. It's a little harder to find. If you've ever been south of the equator, around the equator, and looked for it, you'll know it's kind of a bit trickier, but once you see it, it really stands out, and it's quite beautiful. So that works in a similar way to the North Pole, where the South Pole is pointing kind of directly at the crux, and as the Earth spins and rotates, it's always still pointing at the crux, so it'll always bring you south. It's kind of like if you are sitting in an office chair that spins and you look up at a light fixture that's, like, right above you and spin around, that light fixture is not going to, you know, appear to move around in the ceiling. But if there's something a foot away from it, it's going to spin around in a circle as you move around.
Okay, so next time your kids are up late and you want to go outside and you want to find Polaris and the crux, how do I do that?
Yeah, so Polaris is pretty easy to find. If you have a clear night sky, the first step is finding the Big Dipper, which, if you look around, you'll find it. Stands out generally. So the two stars that make the kind of end of the ladle on the Big Dipper are called Merak and Dubhe. And if you draw a line from the two ends of that ladle away from the Big Dipper, away from the handle, it'll point directly at Polaris, which is the end of the ladle of the Little Dipper. So if you can find the Little Dipper right away, you're already there. Just find the end of the ladle, and that's Polaris. Or sorry, the end of the handle.
Excellent. And the crux, how would we do that if we could see
it? The crux is a little trickier to find. The crux takes a little bit more work. It's not as easy to find, but there are some tips for finding the crux in the book. It does take a little bit more work, though.
We've been talking about sun, stars. Let's talk about water. You write about swells and tides and winds, but you also talk about the heave log. I think some sailors will know this term. Can you explain the heave log?
Yeah, the heave log is a really basic kind of rudimentary way of measuring your distance. So the heave log was used on ships kind of around the 1500s, 1400s, something like that. Those early days of crossing oceans for Europeans. And essentially one person would toss a log off the front of the ship, off the bow, and another crew member would count how long it took until it passed the stern of the ship or the back of the ship. And they would take these readings, you know, every maybe half hour, 10 minutes, however detail-oriented the captain was, and then they would use that to calculate their distance. So they would calculate their speed using just a log being tossed off the ship.
And then there is a chapter in the book called Distance and Dead Reckoning. Can you define dead reckoning behind the name?
The history behind the name. The name has some kind of murky origin. So dead reckoning is this idea of it's this idea of distance. It's figuring out your known previous position or your fix, which is you'd say, okay, we're at these coordinates, and then given a straight traveling in a straight line, you'd find out how far you'd gone. But the history of the name is kind of some sailor's lore there that, you know, on one side you're thinking it's, okay, dead being short for deduced reckoning. Others say dead ahead because it only works if you go straight. And others say that kind of is a nod to the seriousness of getting it right. If you don't get it right, you'll be dead.
So Hans, we talked about some of the different activities in your book. We can find north and south by reading trees. We can get our bearings using the sun. You tell us how to use the stars to tell time in the book. But you also write, pound for pound, you'd be hard-pressed to find any gadget more influential on human history than the human compass. And there is an activity to make your own simple compass. Back that statement up.
Yeah,
why do you believe that?
Yeah, making your own compass is really the first thing we think of when we think of navigation. And it made a lot of the kind of older way, like the using the stars, still useful, but it made navigation a lot more accessible. It was a lot faster to kind of figure out your direction, and it made it where it was cheaper too. A lot of those older navigation tools like astrolabes and sextants were really expensive. And so now with the compass, it was where, you know, most people could get their hands on one. They got cheaper and cheaper, and it really drove a lot more people to start navigating.
Do you call it the almighty compass? And can you give us a quick tutorial on how to make it?
Yeah, so to make your own compass, you only need a few really simple household materials. A magnet, for sure, that's essential. A paperclip, a bowl of water, and like a plastic milk or soda bottle cap. And you magnetize the paperclip, straighten it out, and then you magnetize it by rubbing it on the magnet going the same direction. Kind of like if you're like, imagine whittling with wood. Mm-hmm. You don't want to rub it back and forth. You rub it the same direction for about a minute. And then set it on top of your plastic cap in your bowl of water, and that needle will write itself in the water in a north-south direction. Pretty much right away. It's pretty incredible to watch if you've never done it yourself.
There's a lot of fun activities in here, and there's further reading in the back of the book. The name of it is How to Go Anywhere and Not Get Lost. Hans Ascham is its author. Great illustrations, by the way, in the book by Andres Lozano. Hans, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Allison. Appreciate it.